Good evening again, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming here tonight to hear A.M. Holmes. I won't take too much of your time. On behalf of the National Book Awards Foundation, on behalf of Joe Melillo, Karen Brooke Hopkins, and Suzanne Youngerman, I'm very pleased to welcome you here to BAM. Now, it's my great pleasure to introduce Harold Augenbrom, the Executive Director of the National Book Foundation, wonderful co-curator for this event. Please join me in welcoming Harold.
Thank you, Violan. I want to thank BAM for all its hospitality here. They are really wonderful to work with. I'll give a pitch for money for BAM in a little while. I was going to get up here actually today. You know, I'm usually just the warm-up. I'm the literary warm-up. I sort of ease you from, you know, BAM into the literary program. So I was going to get up here today and tell you not to be depressed about the stock market. But the stock market went up for 3 days in a row. So, you know, there's certain things that if there are like these catchwords, you know, that you say and people applaud or they get, for example, if I say Obama, everybody just goes, whoa, you know, if I say Madoff, everybody goes, whoa. But, you know, that's one of those things. The stock market went up today, so went up the last 3 days. So I can't really get up here and say, don't be depressed about the market. So what I'm going to say instead is you should be happy about the market. And the fact that all of your stocks, and I know everybody here is very well invested in the stock market, all of your stocks have gone up 7 or 8% in the last 3 days, right? So what should you do with all that extra money? Well, the first thing you should do is you should invest it wisely. So I'm going to give you investment tips from the National Book Foundation. So the investment tip from the National Book Foundation is you should buy books. Now, what should you buy? Okay, I'm going to tell you why you should buy a specific book today. You should buy one of A.M. Holmes' books. Now, why should you buy one of A.M. Holmes' books is here? Because A.M. Holmes is here, she can sign it for you, and immediately doubles in value. Now, where are you going to get, except through Bernie Madoff, your investment to double in value in such a short period of time? So do that. The second thing you can do with your all this extra money that you have now is that since you can give, one of the things to do is to give gifts of appreciated stock. Now, you should take all of the stock that has gotten all this extra money over the last couple of days. You should give that stock to BAM for its new building campaign, because they're trying to raise, what, $300 million? So take your appreciated stock and give it to BAM. So there's my literary, this is how you should invest your money, because then you can come here from now until doomsday. What do you want to do, give it to the Brooklyn Dodgers? They left town. Give it to BAM. They've been here for 150 years. There's my literary tips for the evening. Now, I want to tell you how the evening is going to go. What we're going to do is I'm going to introduce the interviewer, Evan Sweeney, and then she will come up here. She will introduce our speaker for the evening. Then we will have a reading, and then the interviewer and the speaker will wait down there. The technical people will come up. They will set them up here. They'll have a conversation for about 15 or 20 minutes. After the conversation, we'll open it up to the floor. You can ask questions. I think that's it for the evening. So without further ado, let me introduce our interviewer for this evening. Evan Sweeney is our moderator. She is a graduate of Harvard University. She won the Harvard Scholarship and the Elizabeth Carey Agassiz Award when she was at Harvard. She has an MFA from the University of Virginia. She's the director of the Center for the Humanities at the CUNY Graduate Center. She helped found the Leon Levy Biography Center for Biography. She is the author of the novel, among other things, I've Taken Up Smoking. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Evan Sweeney.
Thank you, Harold, for that economics lesson. I'm going to move you into the verbal section of this evening. I want to thank Leslie as well. This has been a really fun thing for me to do. I've done a bunch of these interviews, and I always really enjoy myself, particularly because you guys tend to ask really nice questions, and the whole vibe is generally really nice. I am actually referring to these other interviews because the last time I did this, it was for Louise Erdrich. And when I was introducing her, I said something about how whether you're a writer or not, Erdrich's work gives you this feeling that the writer and not just the reader in you is nurtured. And I thought a lot about this word nurture. I talked to Leslie about it. And I kept thinking it was bad that I used that because I would never use that to describe a man's work. And I thought about getting rid of it. But it occurred to me that actually I was using it in a very particular way in reference to the fact that motherhood and family is actually so central to Louise Erdrich's work. And it occurred to me that tonight was actually an opportunity to emphasize that generalizations about women's writing are rarely true. And that, in case you thought I made one, tonight we have proof that women who do write about family and motherhood are not always writing it in a nurturing kind of way. Nurturing is not a word I would use for A.M. Holmes' work, her work in particular. It is often, on the contrary, provocative, unsettling, and even, I think I would use the word, disturbing. When Holmes writes about motherhood, she tends to focus not on its eternal wisdom, but its capacity for deep psychological damage. Her writing probes, hurts, and picks fights, dwells on sanctioned desires and unlikable characters. And often these characters are male. Her first novel, Jack, told the story of a young teenager despising his father for coming out to him. The End of Alice, which was described in the New York Times as having been conceived with an almost flagrant contempt for, as well as a gleeful manipulation of readers' defenses, is narrated from the point of view of a convicted child molester and murderer. Her most recent novel, This Book Will Save Your Life, tells the story of a perversely controlled stockbroker careening off his exercise machine into a world of pain and feeling. Every one of her novels, including the inky, dark parental landscapes of A Country of Mothers and the hilarious Music for Torching, along with her many stories, one of which she will read tonight, challenge literary and social convention, moving in and out of fantasy, domesticity, nightmare, small talk, and slapstick before her lucky readers have a chance to get comfortable. There would be no such thing as modernism without bad behavior and good discomfort, I say to all of you as you move on to wine and dessert. And our best writers, I think, including, I may add, for those of you who would rightfully rise to her defense, Louise Erdrich, serve it up in spades. Holmes has been called a satirist and an absurdist, a modernist and a postmodernist, a genius, an iconoclast. And I think it is not a stretch to acknowledge that she is all of these things, stepping gracefully down the darkly comic path laid by Samuel Beckett and out into the bright, silly pop world whenever she likes. She is a hero to those of us who still think about writing as a volatile and powerful art, and it is a great pleasure to welcome her to the stage.
Thank you. So it's funny because we talked earlier today, and after we talked, I changed what I was going to read, and then I just changed it again. So now I'm really in trouble. First, I thought, oh, I'm going to read this piece I wrote that just was in The New Yorker last week that really came from the painter Eric Fischel's work. And then after we talked today, I thought, no, I'll just read the memoir. Everyone always wants me to really read the memoir, and I have a lot on my mind, and I know I can read the memoir. And then as you were talking, I thought, I'm not reading the memoir. It's all nice and nurturing. And, you know, it's a fairly, well, it's not really a pleasant book, but as my books go, it's one of the more pleasant ones. So with all that you just said, I'm now going to read an abbreviated version of a story called May We Be Forgiven, which is not particularly nurturing at all. It is a story that started, it actually may be the next novel. If I ever write another novel, it's apparently this. Zadie Smith wanted me to write something for this book she was doing of sort of characters, the book of other people that came out. And I started writing this, and I couldn't finish it in time for that. And it just kept going. And it started because I kept thinking, well, what can I write that captures a character really quickly? And I was thinking a lot about anger and angry brothers. And so I started writing, and it just kept going, and I had to give Zadie something else. And then Granta called and said, we're doing our 100th issue. We want something for the issue. I'm like, okay. And I kept sending them other things, and then finally I sent them what I had of this so far, and they ran it, and now it's in the Best American Stories, and it's still not finished is the problem. So I think it actually will be the next novel. And this is, I really chopped it up, just because I have that reputation apparently. Okay, so, and these are the other things I was going to read, but anyway, okay. May We Be Forgiven, or not. Maybe I should call it that. A fable for our time. Was there ever a time you thought, I'm doing this on purpose, I'm fucking up, and I don't know why? The warning sign. 2 years ago, Thanksgiving at their house. I kept watching him as I went back and forth carrying plates into the kitchen. the edges of my fingers dipping into cranberry sauce, sweet potatoes, a cold pearl onion, gristle. With every trip from the dining room to the kitchen, I hated him more. Every sin of our childhood came back. They named him George. Geo, he liked to be called, like it was something cool, scientific, analytical. Geode, I called him, like a sedimentary rock. His wife, Jane, scraped the plates. I stood in their kitchen picking at the carcass while Jane did the dishes, bright blue gloves on, her elbows in suds. My fingers were deep into the bird, the hollow body still warm. I dug with my fingers and brought stuffing to my lips. She looked at me, my mouth moist, greasy, lifted her hands out of the water and came towards me, planting one on me, not friendly. The kiss was serious, wet, full of desire. She did it, then snapped off her gloves and walked out of the room. From Thanksgiving through Christmas and on into New Year, I thought of George fucking Jane. George on top, or once fantastically George having her from the back. I couldn't stop thinking about it. It's almost 9 when Jane calls. I need your help. Don't worry, I say, before I even know what the worry is. I imagine her calling me from the kitchen phone, the long curly cord wrapping around her body. He's at the police station. Did he do something wrong, I ask? Apparently. A fight. On the way to the police station, that's what I'm thinking. George has it in him, a kind of atomic reactivity that stays under the surface until something small triggers him, and he erupts, throwing over a table, smashing his fist through a wall, or something. 33 minutes later, I'm inside a suburban police station. We wanted to take him to the hospital, but he wouldn't go. He just kept repeating he was a dangerous man and we should lock him up and be done with it. Personally, I think the man needs a doctor. You don't walk away from something like that unscathed. So he got into a fight? Car accident. Bad one. Was it his fault? He ran a red light, plowed into a minivan. Husband and daughter were killed on impact. Is my brother being charged with a crime? Not at the moment. George comes out. How come you're here? He asks. Jane called. I lead George to the parking lot and into the night, feeling compelled to take his arm, to guide him, not sure if I'm preventing him from escaping or just steadying him. Where's Jane? At the house. Does she know? I shake my head. No. It was awful, he says. There was a light. Did you see the light? I think I may have seen it, but it was like it didn't make sense. Like it didn't apply to you? Like I just didn't know. He gets into the car. Where's Jane? He asks again. At the house, I repeat. Are you all right? Jane asks when we're inside. How could I be? He says. George empties his pockets onto the kitchen counter. He takes off his shoes, socks, pants, boxers, short shirt, jacket, undershirt, and stuffs it all into the kitchen trash can. Would you like some coffee? Jane asks. Naked, George stands with his head tilted, as if he's hearing something. Coffee? She asks again, gesturing with the pot. He doesn't answer. He walks from the kitchen, through the dining room, and into the living room, and sits in the dark, naked, in a chair. Did he get into a fight? Jane asks. Car accident. You better call your insurance company and your lawyer. Do you have a lawyer? George, do we have a lawyer? Do I need one? He asks. Something's wrong with him, Jane says. He killed people. There's a pause. She pours George a cup of coffee and brings it into the living room, along with a dish towel that she drapes over his genitals, like putting a napkin in his lap. The phone rings. Don't answer it, George says. For a long time, he sits in the chair, the dish towel shielding his privates, the cup of coffee daintily on his lap. Beneath him, a puddle forms. Jane? George? Oh, God. Sorry. Don't fight with me now. This is the part where this is horrible. And then I digress into stand-up comedy, which is what I seem to do often. Anyway, I blow like one line and an hour passes because I'm not going to do it. Friends of mine who know are here. Like, don't start. It turns out, bad Robin Williams. Exactly. That's always what starts it. Okay. George, Jane implores, when she hears what sounds like water running. You're having an accident. Tessie, the old dog, comes over and sniffs it. Jane takes the coffee cup from George and hands it to me. She takes the wet dish towel from his lap and helps him to stand and then wipes off the back of his legs and his ass with paper towels. Let me help you upstairs. I watch as they climb the steps. I see my brother's body slack, his stomach sagging slightly, the bones of his hips, his pelvis, his flat ass, all so white they appear to glow in the dark. As they climb, I see below his ass and tucked between his legs, his low pinkish-purple nutsack swinging like an old lion. I sit on their couch. Where is my wife? Isn't it curious she doesn't know what's happened? Why hasn't she called? The room smells of urine. The wet paper towels are on the floor. Jane doesn't come back to clean up the pee. I do it and sit back on the sofa. I want to go home. I hate this living room. I hate this house. I remember helping them find the house. I remember when they bought it. I remember helping them do things to fix it up. Why do they still live here? Their children are grown. The place is empty. The dog is old. In the morning, there are hurried phone calls and hushed conversations. We will take him to the hospital and they will look for something, some explanation that will relieve him of responsibility. Am I going deaf or what the fuck is going on around here? George wants to know. The next time we see George, he's in the cubicle in the back of the emergency room, arms and legs tied to a gurney. Do you know why you're here? The doctor asks him. I've got bad aim, George says. Later in private, my wife Claire, who's packing to leave for a business trip, tells me not to leave Jane alone. She's very vulnerable. Imagine if it were you. If you went nuts, wouldn't you want someone to stay with me and keep an eye on the house? I stay with Jane, and it is as though we are playing house. At night, I take out the trash, lock the door. She makes a snack. We watch a little television and read. I read whatever it was George had been reading, his newspapers and magazines, and a big history of Thomas Jefferson that sits beside his side of the bed. The accident happened, and then it happened. It didn't happen the night of the accident. It happened the night after. The night after Claire told me not to leave Jane alone. The night after Claire left for China. Claire went on a trip, George went downhill, and then it happened. It was the thing that was never meant to happen. The evening visit to the hospital went badly. For reasons that were not clear, George was locked in a padded room, his arms bound to his body. We came back to the house, had our tea, and went about our business. I changed out of my clothes, the same clothes I'd been wearing for days. I put on a pair of his pajamas and went upstairs. I hugged her. I wanted to be comforting. I was in his pajamas. She was against me. She put her hands down on the sides of her skirt and slid it down. The feel of her was incredible. I remember thinking, this is not really going to happen, is it? She stroked me, looking me straight in the eye, and then her mouth was on me, and there was no way of saying no. Somehow the hospital let him out. Inexplicably, he was able to walk out unnoticed in the middle of the night. I think I remember that part, the dog barking. Or maybe he didn't ring the bell and the dog didn't bark. Maybe he took the spare key from under the mat or from inside the fake rock in the garden by the door and, like an intruder, came silently into his own house. I don't know how long he stood there. I don't know how long he waited before he lifted the lamp from her side of the bed and smashed it down on her head. That's when I woke up. She was screaming. The one blow wasn't enough. She tried to get up. The lamp wasn't even broken. George looked at me and then picked up the lamp again and swung it at her, a big blow like a baseball bat. The porcelain vase that was the base exploded against her head. "Call it in," he said. I stood facing him. We were the same. We had the same gestures, the same faces, the same family chin, my father's brow, the same mismatched selves. An awful gurgling sound prompted me to dial the phone. Accidentally, I drop the phone. I bend to pick it up, and my brother's foot catches me under the chin, kicking me hard. My head snaps back. I see his hospital gown under his clothes, hanging out like some kind of tail. She's making a horrible noise. I dial O. I dial O like it's a hotel, like I expect someone to answer. There's a long recording, a kind of spoken word essay about, well, what the O button can do for you, and I realize it'll be forever before a real person comes on. I hang up, and after several shaky starts, I'm able to call the police. Later, when I went downstairs, George was in the kitchen drinking a cup of coffee. There was blood on his hands and flecks of something on his face. Pieces of lamp, I realized later. Shards. Escort him, one of the cops says. Take the clothes he's wearing as evidence and search what he wants to put on. When George comes back, he's wearing my clothes, the ones I've been wearing for days, the ones I had folded and draped over a chair. Those are my clothes, I say. And those are my pajamas, he says, looking at me. Now you've gone and done it. Before we go, I call Claire in China. There's been an accident. Jane has been injured. Should I come home, Claire asks. No, I say. At the police station, I'm told I'm not a suspect, that they just need to ask a couple of questions to fill in the story. Were you having sex with her when your brother came home? No. The cop drives me to the hospital. The doctors tell me that if Jane survives, she will never be the same. The prognosis is poor. I have to call their children and say, your mother is in a coma and your father's in jail. I visit George on Tuesdays. We speak through holes drilled in thick plexiglass, holes filled with the spittle of every criminal's family that has ever come before us. How are you? I ask. How could I be? It was an accident, I say. I'm not asking for your opinion, George says. How are my roses? He asks. They have black spot. I'll spray again tonight if it doesn't rain. And then I'm going to read you one other very short story. And the odd thing is when we were talking today before this, and I was thinking about stories, this is a story that I wrote for the English artist Sarah Jones to go with an exhibition of her photographs. And you'll see that there's something in the ending that's not dissimilar from what I just read. And I guess it makes me think a little bit about, like, oh, how does my mind work? Or, you know, what are the threads that are the sort of creative threads that run through these things? And this is fairly short. And you'll also get a sense of the, we were also talking earlier today about gender. So that was the boy story, and now here's the girl story. Called, Whose Story Is It and Why Is It Always on Her Mind? She's seeing the doctor now. It was a condition of her release. The thorns, he asks? Yes, she says. Plucked from rose stems, she drove the thorns deep into her skin, pressing them like shark's teeth in a line up and down her arms. She pressed the thorns into her skin until the skin gave way and buried the thorn, and then she took off her shoes and pushed the thorns into her feet and walked from the park to the park, collecting more thorns. Specimens, she called them. Her wounds became infected, the infection spread into her blood. We almost lost you, her mother said. I was right here the whole time, hiding in plain sight. I see you're walking with a limp, the doctor says. I'm treading lightly. Why thorns? It runs in the family. She glances over her shoulder to see if the doctor is listening and catches him off guard. Their eyes meet and she looks away. Continue, the doctor says. She lies back, her fingers stroke the deep blue fabric on the doctor's couch. My mother rearranges the furniture constantly. She's trying to make something that she remembers, but I'm not sure it ever really happened. She says she's getting closer. She's no longer young, but she gathers the energy to push the sofa around the room. And when she's done, she cries. It's always almost there, but not quite. She can't put her finger on it. The light, the silence. Every day she tries a new combination, hoping the pieces will fall into place like the pin tumblers of a lock, hoping there will be an opening and something will be revealed. Where are you going with that? I ask, as she moves a lamp from this table to that. I'm going back to where I came from, she says. But it does not exist, I say. She makes still lives, tableau of how she wishes it were. It is the same sofa, the one from before, she asks me, now confused. That's what you've always told me. I don't know anymore. Maybe it came after the fact. She calls the war the fact. My mother's sofa is also blue. Finished for today, she gets up carefully. The next time she visits the doctor, she notices a hair. She sees it as she's approaching the doctor's couch, a blonde hair like a golden thread glinting in the light. She doesn't know what to do. Pick it up, stretch it between her fingers, pluck it like a harp string. She imagines winding it round and round her finger until the finger turns blue, pressing it against her neck like a fine gold wire. What to do? She pretends not to see it. She lies down on it, the blonde hair beneath her own brown hair, the blonde hair becoming for a time part of her, but she can't bear it. Whose hair is it? Does the doctor have sex on this sofa? My mother was born the day before the war ended. She was a girl without a father, a miracle. For a long time, she believed that. We all did. The fact is, during the war, my grandmother was left at a Catholic boarding school. Her parents brought her there in the middle of the night and left her with the nuns. The way the story goes, he appeared in the garden behind the school. She pretended not to know what happened, but it's possible she really didn't know. It was a war. She was terrified. The only thing that kept her sane was that the roses kept blooming. That's where they found her, entangled in the rose bushes. He came into the garden, bent to smell the roses, and saw her. He pushed her into the roses, and when he was gone, she remained trapped. She lay in the garden all night. She watched the sky go dark and the stars come out. She looked up into the internal blue, the unending, the unnameable. She was asleep when they found her. Grandmother woke up, but only partially. It was as if she was under a spell, in a fog. Sometimes she would come out from under, but mostly she seemed baffled, like it all just didn't make sense. As a child, my mother knew that her mother hated her, but didn't know what she'd done wrong. My mother kept herself hiding, in boxes or under a table, inside closets. She would pretend she was invisible. She would play chameleon and practice shifting her skin to match the environment. When other children came to play, my mother would hide, and only after they left would she rush to the window, pressing her face to the glass and look at them leaving. My mother found out when she was about 13. She doesn't remember how, but she said it explained a lot. When she found out, she went on a nighttime rampage to the parks of London and cut the roses. She brought back hundreds of roses and filled my grandmother's house with roses from bud to bloom to pass their prime. Cabbage rose, common rose, tea rose, each with delicate petals like human flesh, each with a perfume, a beautiful scent turned putrid. The theft of the roses was a crime. The story of the theft made all the papers, and her mother was horrified and threatened to turn her over to authorities. "I can't have this. It's too much. You're doing it to me again. You're just like your father. You are the proof that you can't escape your history." And together they cut the roses and their long, thorny stems into tiny pieces and boiled them down. She pauses. "Does anyone have a life of their own?" she asks the doctor. He doesn't answer. Her third visit is different. There's something on the sofa like a doily or a napkin covering the little pillow. Is the hair still beneath it? Is it being hidden, kept safe? She lies back and says nothing. She looks at the room, the light through the windows, a lamp, part of a painting, an extra chair, a table with a plant. She's thinking of her mother moving furniture, of her grandmother trapped in the roses. She stares at the plant, a beautiful white and purple orchid, and wonders, did the doctor buy it or receive it as a gift? "Is it real?" she asks. "Does it look real?" the doctor answers. When the session is over, she sits up. The room spins, a kaleidoscope blurring. She falls back onto the sofa. She cannot get up. "Your time is up for today," the doctor says. He seems flummoxed. This has not happened before. He goes to his desk, rummages through a drawer, and finds a tin of hard candy. He offers her one. It is red and in the shape of a rose. She sucks. The sugar, the sucre, works wonderful, wonders. She dreams she is walking on water, and it is raining rose petals.
Thank you. So now we're both a little thrown because she did tell me she's going to read something different. So I had prepared a few different questions, but actually we can just start
with
the story you just read, which was really beautiful and actually right along the lines of the things that I was talking about in my introduction, obviously. So I guess I would ask first, what is it that makes you gravitate towards motherhood, actually? And I mean, ideas about motherhood and all that pain.
I don't know. You know, it's funny. I don't know. This is going to sound like the strangest thing. I almost was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. It's funny. I don't think of that story in relation to motherhood. Yeah. I think of it very much in relation to Sarah Jones's photographs, which are, she took a whole series of photographs of analysts' couches, actually, in New York City, and also of roses in England. So it's funny that would be the question. I don't think that I really write that much about motherhood.
In a Country of Mothers,
yeah, I wrote that,
the
like,
memoir
long...
about your mother.
Yeah, but look, I had the prison book. I don't know. I'm not. It is weird to say.
Which
I'm
has
not...
a mother in it.
Yeah, I'm not. It's gonna. I know. I never thought about it. No, it's really making me say I'm not that interested in mothers. I am a mother now, and that's supposed to make me very interested in mothers. But it doesn't. You know, people say, "When are you going to write about your daughter?" I'm like, I don't know her well enough. You know.
Yeah. Fair enough.
So I know it's funny to say it's not the thing that interests me most. And, you know, in the memoir, my assistant, my own mother, I have so many of them, the one who raised me, there's not that much about her, and there's a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
That's
enough.
Another reason. Yeah.
So another thing that I know you maybe are going to feel like you don't care that much about is gender that we talked about briefly.
No, yeah.
And you know, in
I
reference...
I think it's good we all have one. At
yeah.
least, or two.
We seem to, yeah.
Three.
Yeah. So the first story was...
yeah.
I mean, I must say, I actually have a little bit of a pet peeve about authors who take on sure. the opposite gender, I often find it kind of excruciating
Why?
When it goes wrong.
Right.
Particularly yeah. with men. There's like, you know, typically a kind of teenage girl looking at her new breasts in the shower, and it's like really irritating to me. But you do it really beautifully. There's never a moment where you don't believe that somehow you might have actually felt like that lion that is featured in your
sure.
story that you just right. read. And there's lots of sex, and there's lots of desire and stuff
right.
like that.
Right.
So I wonder, I mean, if you kind of, if you mean to get at something by going in the opposite direction from where you came from, or...
Sure. I mean, that's a good... It is a good question, and I think that the truth of the answer is that I feel incredibly comfortable writing in a male voice, and I feel incredibly comfortable in writing in a male voice that is a male who's slightly older than me. And if I was being brutally honest, I would say, looking at my own history, you know, I have this dead brother who's like 9 years older than me. And I think it's, you know, and then there was the Halloween that I went like as Willie Loman in my father's suit with the skinhead wig. It's only fourth grade. So I think that there is, it's a natural occurring phenomena. Do you know what I mean? That there is some piece of me that for whom that way of thinking and writing comes entirely naturally. And I remember even in graduate school getting in trouble because I wrote some play and the feminist playwriting teacher said to me, if a man had written this, I would be very angry. And I'm like, you know. And I think that, you know, for me, it's one of the things that has given me sort of a great sense of, I don't know if pleasure or comfort is the right word, but on the last novel, This Book Will Save Your Life, Stephen King read it, and we got this great quote from him. And it wasn't just getting the quote from Stephen King. It was that guy was believable to him. Mm-hmm. And the story that came out last week in The New Yorker, I got a lot of emails from my older male friends saying, oh, it's amazing how you understand the aging male psyche. I'm thinking, like, I think, unfortunately, I have that psyche, too. I mean, I have other ones also.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know...
Do you think that there's something you're capable of in a male voice that you wouldn't be in a female voice? Do you think that female voices don't...
Well,
can't say the things you want to say.
I think that's a very interesting question. And we were talking a little about this earlier today. You know, Grace Paley, who was a teacher of mine, we had this very funny conversation once, and Grace said, you know, that women had done men writers the favor of reading their work for many, many years, and that the favor had not been returned. And I think that that's true. I don't think many men go into the bookstore and be like, what's the best book by a woman lately, you know? Because I think that they read male writers, and I think women read everybody, basically. In terms of what that male voice allows me to talk about, one of the things Grace talked about was that historically women wrote sort of more domestic stories and small, not in a, she wasn't saying this in a critical sense, smaller stories, but the frame was somewhat smaller, and men wrote these, you know, sweeping social novels. And I think that what I do is really in some ways very much in between, that I'm very interested in the domestic, but from a point of view that is otherwise kind of not particularly represented anywhere, which is funny because I don't think of myself as a woman writer. I think of myself as a writer, and that's very important to me. And I don't, in that sense, when we were talking, I was talking to you earlier and saying, you know, I'm really not into gender. People, and I remember even Cindy Sherman and I, the photographer, once having this conversation, and feminists are always wanting to use Cindy's work as illustrations of various things about gender. And Cindy's like, I'm not, you know, on the one hand, gender is very important. On the other hand, it's not the first thing that I think of, and it's not in that way. But I think what I do also means I don't fall into the category of what typical women write about, typical women writers write about, or whatever. Never. Mm-hmm. Oh, never mind. And then it's just interesting because when I think about the women writers whose work, you know, I really admire and who's sort of, you know, I like Joan Didion. I mean, there's not that many contemporary women writers, I think, there that I wish I could write their books. Or I wish I had written
books. As opposed to men, or?
Well, yeah, actually, sure, yeah. You know, when I think of, I'm just going to dig myself into the dirt tonight. we really thought she was going to be nice, and she's horrible. No, but, you know, like Jane Ann Phillips is a contemporary who I really admire her work, and I remember reading those stories early on. And I love people like Amy Hempel and Laurie Moore, but I don't identify work-wise with them. Mm-hmm. They are writing about a different area. And I think there are very few women writers who sort of are working in the way that I'm working or in the subject matter. I mean, how many, you know, it's even when End of Alice came out, which is the novel about the jailed pedophile murderer, I think the only reason I didn't get just completely just ripped to shreds, and I got fairly ripped to shreds, was because it was hard for people to believe that a woman had written that book. It made no sense to them because they thought, well, how could a woman, on top of all this insult, how could a woman have done this, you know, written these horribly dirty things and whatever, you know, whatever.
I would offer Deborah Eisenberg as a possible contender.
Yeah, but different too in some way. I mean,
sure.
I mean, she's wonderful.
Well, maybe we could talk a little bit about what you think your role as a writer is. I mean, what is that job? You asked Grace Paley that question.
Yeah.
What is a writer's job?
I think if I remember right, Grace talked about how that it was like being, if you were a plumber, you had to be the best plumber. You had to just do a good job at your thing. I think what I really feel about it. I'm flying later tonight, so I've taken like a truth serum. So ask me anything. But what I really think is that I write hoping to cause people to think and cause people to think about the world they live in and their own relationships differently, in the sense that I'm not ever saying this is how you should think about them, but it's important to me to write books that provoke thought and also that raise questions about things. You know, they need to be sort of a challenge. And I would say, that said, I also want to write books that are very readable and that are sort of, in a structural sense, fairly traditional, because I'm not trying to challenge people on that level, which there are. I mean, that is a choice that many other writers make. But I think of books like, you know, John Steinbeck's books, and I think it's amazing because you can read John Steinbeck's books, you know, in fourth grade and then in college, and they're not about vocabulary, but the story, every time you read it, it changes because of where you are and what you now know about the world around you and how it sort of fits in with those things. And I think, to me, you know, that was one of the most wonderful things, was reading Steinbeck very young and then reading him later. So I think that, you know, the role is to also, I think a lot about writing about the world that I live in and the times that I live in some way, and not as a pure document of them, because that doesn't so much interest me, but is a kind of a condensed version of it. So like, you know, when the spaceship lands at some point and they find one of my books, they're like, oh, we know these people, you know?
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
I know, you know, if there still are books, and sure, when the spaceships land, it's hard to know what will be here. I asked if this was going to again, the digression into comedy. I don't know if you all know the Music Together song, Hello Everybody. This is a motherhood thing. So there's a song that when you have a child, apparently you immediately roll them in this program called Music Together. And they sing this song. It's their chant. Hello Everybody, we're so glad to see you. And they go, hello AM, we're so glad to see you. I'm convinced that when this mothership lands in like 30 years, it will open and it will start to play Hello Everybody, and an entire generation is going to flock onto the ship.
Yeah. My daughter's favorite song on that little Music Together thing is the Taxi one. But anyway.
Roll the windows up.
So they could well say that to the...
I know.
Yeah,
well, that's right, exactly. There's a couple ships coming. They don't just know. There's the father ship.
What was the question I was going to ask? Sorry. Oh, it was, and actually you sort of stepped aside from this to say that you don't actually want to lead people in a certain direction of thinking. I did notice in sort of reading over your work that your last two novels do seem to show kind of signs of redemption, a little bit more light than you had let in the first bunch. And I'm wondering if you feel like you can feel that, and if something's changed over the course of your writing.
Yeah, and then people always ask, that's when motherhood also comes back in. Like, now that you're a mom, do you feel like better about the world? No. the thing about that, when you asked, I started to laugh, because the last novel, This Book Will Save Your Life, is slightly more upbeat. And I would say it was so much harder to write a book that kind of ended with some hope or some possibility, much harder than to write a downer. And interestingly, I got slammed for it. And I thought, wow, this is like, interestingly, in this country, all over Europe, the book is like, people are loving it. It's all about America. It's such an American novel. And in this country, people hated it. Critics hated it. People actually liked it. They're not the same as critics. But But people, the critics really slammed it. And they slammed it because it had this, like, hopeful thing. That was what they were talking about. And for me, it actually weirdly was, that was the first book that I wrote after 9/11. And having been witnessed, literally, to the planes crashing and seeing the whole thing and thinking about how do we think positively in a time that is so not negative, but in such a complex time, and how do we live in a way that is about our responsibilities to each other and as a much larger community. So that's really what I was thinking about, which oddly, me being me, that's a novel set in Los Angeles. There's no mention of New York ever. But it really, for me, that's what where that came out of. And thinking about how do you find a way up from that? And I think about that a lot anyway lately. So it's not that I am so encouraged. And actually, the May We Be Forgiven, I am trying to write it as a novel. And it is so damn depressing. And it's not funny. And it's these brothers are horrible people. And one, it turns out, one angrier than the next. And it's just like killing me to do. And I'm not sure. Then I think, well, then don't do it. And I'm like, no, I have to. Because I have this theory, if you don't write the book that you're like, you have to write, then it just, everything breaks.
So just to clarify, the difficulty of that positive redemption was maybe a slight change in direction of your kind of moral obligation as a writer? Or
no, I mean, I think it was very much in keeping with the same thing, which is really, I mean, writing about the world I live in and the time I live in, and the question, you know, being how do you go forward and how do you sort of function in the world that we live in? I don't think, I don't know, that there was any overt sense of like, I must be forced to be optimistic now. But I was really thinking a lot about community and responsibility. And I do believe that there are things that we can do for other people that we can't do for ourselves, positive things. It's much easier to, you know, ask for money for somebody for a foundation that you believe in than to say, oh, can you give me $5,000? I just kind of want it, you know? You know what I mean? Rather than saying, like, you know, well, this will get us free speech and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, I believe a lot. I have this, like, people think of me as this very transgressive person, and I am the person who helps someone across the street with their groceries. But even when they're not asking for help, which is probably a little weird, I'm like, do you need help? You know, I accost strangers. It's very, you know, do you need directions? I don't know. I must not get out enough or something.
You can carry my groceries anytime. But in the meantime...
What's the address?
I need to open up to the floor because I don't want to steal all your time. So I'm imagining that we probably have some questions out there. We usually do.
Do you have, like, deli numbers? Well, I know, you know, I have... Well, for that, I now have, like, 500 or 600 pages of notes. And I keep saying to myself, okay, Holmes, where's the book? I'm like, oh, it's coming. Let's just give me a couple more years. Writing these books, it really is like having a relationship with these people. And it's a strange thing. More so than I think many other writers that I know, I really work from my imagination, whether it's the pedophile guy or, you know, the murderous brothers or anybody. And I make these people up, and they are really entirely real to me. And it's not always pleasant. I mean, after I wrote The End of Alice, I felt truly dark. You know, I felt awful. I mean, I felt sick, really. And it was a very uncomfortable feeling. And I also thought, I'm going to be writing in this weird voice for a really long time. And I'm always going to, like, rhyme, and it's just going to be kind of, you know. So, yeah, it is. They're very real. And they said to say hi. No, I'm just kidding. Oh, can't help it. Well, that's a good question. I think the short version was... Does the lure of writing about sort of people on the edges and the periphery of experience come from my childhood experience? And I would say a couple things. I would say what really in part comes from my childhood experience is a compulsion to tell truth. I grew up in a family where, no joking, one day I looked out the window and went, Mom, the backyard's on fire. My mother said, no, it's not. I'm like, well, I'll call the fire department if you won't. I mean, literally the backyard was on fire. There were like flames. No, it's not. So that said... And it's funny because we were talking earlier about this. The piece, the New Yorker story a couple weeks ago, came out of Eric Fischel's paintings and looking at Eric Fischel's paintings. And what I always used to, when I was a younger person, I also always loved Eric's work. And he always painted really a kind of emotional truth and a kind of truth that was often vaguely sexual and about relationships between adults and children and what people knew and saw but couldn't say. And I think that's an area that always has interested me. And it's not so much that I think about the edges of people's experience, but I think a lot about, you know, I think we all know things about ourselves that we don't want to know that we know. And I'm right there. And I'm right there just poking at that and going, well, I'm going to find out. You know, and I think it scares people. And I think sometimes, you know, I've been on book tour and people will say things to me like, do you really think people talk the way you write that? You know, and I'm like, yeah, they do. You know, couples talk to each other in horrible ways, and And not that the books are all about horrible things, too. They're also funny, but they are about our private selves and the parts of ourselves that we don't always want to sort of acknowledge. And I think that that's a very interesting place where you're sort of drawn towards something and also sort of like freaked out by it because it does ring a bell. You know, people always, I get these reviews like, she's a shocking writer. And to me, shocking means it hits a nerve. It doesn't mean it's right or wrong or good or bad. It means you're talking about something that people find threatening. And I think, well, that's okay. I mean, that doesn't worry me. It would be more upsetting to me if I wrote something that got no reaction. Because I think, back to the drawing board. Because it's important to me, and I don't have any desire to shock or to try to surprise people in that way, but I do have a desire to kind of talk about things that are not easy to talk about. So ask anything you want to ask. It's the truth serum. No. No, that's the desire for health insurance, actually, which is very real. I wrote the film adaptation of Jack a long time ago, and then I took a job actually writing on The L Word, which was a show that oddly enough was about people that I knew. It was sort of based on people I know, and I wanted the truth was I wanted to create my own show. But TV is a catch-22, and they'll never let you create your own show unless you've worked on a show. And I really didn't know how else to get a job at television. So I emailed them and said, like, can I come work on your show? And they said, sure. You know, like, please come and work on the show. And funny enough, my job was to fix Jenny. Now, I don't know if anyone has seen that show, but...
She needs a lot of fixing.
Yeah, well, So they said, you know, we want you to come and fix Jenny. And then it turned out that Jenny was really, in many ways, the alter ego of the executive producer. So you really wouldn't want to be trying to fix Jenny in any kind of way. But that said, I don't know what has gotten into me tonight. I didn't take any medication. I'm just going on this flight later. I'm a little nervous about it, the old midnight flight. But what I really loved about it, I hadn't had a job since 1985. I worked for Random House for 1 year. That was my entire professional life. We had to get dressed and go to work. And more important to me than could I do a good job writing TV was like, can I go to work every day? What do you do at work every day? Well, I stay awake for the entire day. My anxieties were really not like, you know, can I write TV? It was more like, can I just sit upright? And so it was shocking to me that I could sit upright, and they serve snacks. Now, I don't know if other environments are like this, but we sat on rubber bouncy balls, you know, the kind that they have at the gym, and made up lies and stories, and they serve snacks all day. So I, you know, and I got health insurance. So for me, it was kind of great. And so I did it for 2 years, and then I was offered sort of an emeritus position, which meant that I could come and make up all the stories, but then I'd have to go home so they wouldn't have to pay me the whole amount. And I said, you know, that's not going to happen. And my two other contributions, which is, again, like gets to exactly the problem people have with me, is my contribution to The L Word was, you need more men. So I had to hire Adam Rapp, the playwright, and put Wally Shawn on the show. Those were my two biggest things. I was like, this show needs more men. I just don't understand. I don't fit in anywhere.
There's a question over there.
Even in my own home. Yeah, go ahead. That's interesting. Can you tell me, before I answer, I'm curious, can you say a little bit more about how you found it disturbing or what ways? Sure, I didn't mean to. Not the quiz the audience portion. Well, here's what I will say, and it's an interesting, and I think that's very interesting. I felt like a couple things about writing The Mistress's Daughter. So The Mistress's Daughter is this true story. It's a true story. It's my true story. And I'm getting there. It takes me a while. I was given up for adoption. I'm up for adoption again soon, by the way, if anyone knows. A family who wants an adult and a child and a dog. But I come with some assets and things, so it's not so bad. Anyway. And my biological mother came and found me when I was 32, very out of the blue. And it's a story about that. And it was a very disconcerting experience. And as it was happening and as the sort of events were unfolding, I took notes. And part of it for me is that's how I process information. I write things down. And I started to write something down. And I really wanted at first just to create a document for myself. I just thought, this is just such a strange story. I have to just write it down, because I was also aware, even if I couldn't articulate it, how over time memory shifts and things shift and experience shift, and I just wanted to hold it fixed in the place where it had happened in some way. So I wrote about 100 pages, and I gave it to somebody very important in my publishing life who hated it. And I promptly stopped writing. And I didn't anticipate either that the person would hate it or B, that I would still stop writing. And I would go back and I would say to myself, come on, just finish it for yourself. It's the whole point of this wasn't, you know, to make a book. It was about telling the story for yourself. And I would sort of start again a little bit and get bits and pieces done. And then a few years ago, Grant has said to me, we're doing this adoption anthology. And everyone knew that there was sort of a story in this thing. And I had a contract from the New Yorker that I had for 7 years and never turned the piece in. And I thought to myself, okay, come on. There's got to be in that 100 pages something. And I went back and I read the 100 pages and I thought, this is the story. There's nothing even to change, which to me was very interesting that there was nothing about it that I would rewrite, which meant to me really that I had told the story as best I could and as truthfully as I could. And ultimately, the New Yorker ran a piece of it and Grant ran a piece of it. And then I still hadn't really finished it, and I decided that I was going to then finish it. And I wrote the second half, which is very different. And my idea for the second half was that I really wanted to kind of crack the story open, I mean, literally like hitting it with a sledgehammer, and that the first half was a very kind of traditional narrative in many ways. But to get to what you're saying, I felt like from my perspective that the telling of the story benefited from my experience as a writer, that many memoirs that I had read were not very well written and sort of worked in a way that was about just the telling of the experience that prompted the memoir rather than, you know, sort of the more literary memoir or a different kind of telling of it. So for me, I thought I probably couldn't have really written it if I hadn't had the experience of also trying to find language for very primitive experience, for, you know, emotion that really occurred before I had language. And, you know, in the early parts when I was like writing it would be like, you know, I'm mad. I'm so mad. This hurts horribly. But how do you turn that into something that, you know, other people can read? And I think for me, ultimately, in the publishing of that, I'm not really a writer who writes overtly a lot about myself. Obviously, threads go through things, but I went ahead and published it because I felt like it would have meaning for other people. And it did. And that was in a way, and people sort of, other people who'd written memoirs, you know, sort of what they called warned me and said, oh, when you get out there on book tour, you'll see it's so different. And it's true. People come up and they want to tell you their stories and they want to share what's happened in their life. And adoption, whether it's someone who has given a child up for adoption or a family that has an adopted child or a person who was adopted, you know, almost probably everybody in this room in one way or another knows of an experience in that way. And so it was fascinating to see, again, in a whole different way, but what the book prompted in terms of conversation and people talking to each other and all that. So I wouldn't really want to do it again in the sense that I didn't particularly, in retrospect, love the level of exposure. And it really is a piece of my life. It's not the entirety of my life by any means. But I much prefer the kind of truth-telling and the kind of exploration I get to do in writing real fiction and working from my imagination. But, you know, it was a very disturbing, I mean, I have to say it was a very disturbing experience in the sense that it's so hard to articulate. You think you're one person. Like I thought it was A.M. Holmes, this writer that I had kind of created, knowing that I really wasn't the child of Susan Sontag and Jack Kerouac, which was my, of course, early fantasy, that they met, had a one-night stand. It couldn't have gone on longer. And there I was. And I mean, it's a joke, but it also, there is this thing growing up when you make a creation for yourself. And then for these people to sort of appear out of the blue and to find out I'm not who I thought I was, and yet I have no idea who I am, was profoundly unnerving. And I think, I mean, in many ways, I think it's really lucky I survived. And it's really lucky it didn't happen when I was much younger, because I don't know what I would have done with it then. And, you know, my biological parents, my mother had a horrible life and really came back looking for me, I think, as a way to try to put her own life back together. I mean, she just had a really unfortunate whole life. And my father is, I think, kind of a jerk, you know. But, you know. And I sort of, it was important to me, too, also to sort of let the story tell itself about, to not comment so much on their behavior, but just sort of let their behavior speak for itself. But it's, I don't know, it's just interesting and strange. You know, so I'm sure it is disturbing. Boy, that was a long answer. And now it's morning. I missed the plane.
I know. We have to get you on your plane. And I just I want to admit that it was me who slipped the truth serum into your wine. So I hope you guys will all thank you me for that. And thank Am Homes for talking with us tonight.